Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello.
Brother Wayne, it's Matt. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You?
I'm doing all right. Yeah. You know, it's been a bit of a weird year, hasn't it? But we're here, so that's something to be grateful for.
Indeed.
Where's home for you these days? Where are you living?
In Los Angeles.
And what's the mood like over there at the moment? Obviously, I know it's been, COVID aside, a pretty crazy time over there this year. What with, you know, the protest movements and wildfires and watching it from this side of the pond, it's been like, you know, watching some form of apocalyptic movie unfold. How have you found this year personally?
Yeah, it's dystopian.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a hell of a year. You know, California is a blue state. So, you know, in my world and my friends, we're all kind of on the same page, but I know the rest of the country, you know, there's about a 30% population of the electorate that, you know, they find Donald Trump to be their champion.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not going to go away if Trump goes away.
Yeah. And I mean, for you personally, you've obviously lived through, you know, all kinds of different eras of politics, and you've seen it all in your lifetime. The last 4 years for you, how would you characterize them? Have they been drastically different to, you know, terms of office that have come before? Like, what's Trump's state in power been like for somebody like yourself who has, you know, spent his whole life opposing people like him? How would you characterize life as an American, you know, and a Democrat for the last 4 years?
It's been horrific. I get this question from time to time, and I used to say, well, you know, the Vietnam War, 55,000 young Americans died, so that was worse. But now, you know, Donald Trump has directly been responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of Americans. So, you know, this is worse than it was in the 60s. The corruption is worse. The disconnect between the truth and a lie has become worse. You know, the general, you know, sense of confidence about the future is much worse.
How do you feel about the upcoming election? How do you see that panning out?
Well, I've been clocking it pretty closely, and all indications say that Americans are sick of Donald Trump, and they will not vote him in for another term. Of course, it's like horse racing. Anything could happen.
Yeah. Well, that was proven four years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, and no one was more shocked than Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think he thought, oh, God, the joke's gone too far. I saw a really interesting documentary about how it all started, and I don't know to what extent this is complete accuracy, but they were exploring the roots of his campaign and how it all got, you know, geared up, and they were trying to say that it was because he was on that show and he found out that Gwen Stefani was getting paid more than him to be on The Voice, and that was what sent his ego into overdrive, and he wanted to kick back at the networks, and that was how the whole political campaign got started. I don't know to what extent that's 100% true, but if it is, damn you, Gwen Stefani.
Yeah, well, that and his petty, small, but all-encompassing desire, his resentment for Barack Obama, I think it had a lot to do with that White House correspondence dinner where, you know, Barack and a couple other people made jokes at Trump's expense, and, you know, he cannot tolerate being teased or being mocked. And I mean, it's petty and it's small, but that's who he is.
Do you think he'll get reelected, or do you think he's on his way out?
I think he's on his way out.
Well, that's good.
Certainly, that's my fervent hope.
Yeah, no doubt. I want to tell you a quick story, Wayne, before we get into the story of your, you know, storied and incredible life. I want to share with you my first ever moment live on radio. So I've been doing this stuff for about 10 years now, radio shows, TV shows, podcasts. And my first ever appearance on air was guesting on my friend's radio show in Exeter in England at the time. And he said, why don't you come on and play 10 songs? So I took in 10 vinyl records and I wanted to kind of trace what I thought was the evolution of punk, which is a genre that means a lot to me. And for me, it begins, I would say you could even trace it back to the 50s. For me, Little Richard was punk and the Sonics and, you know, there was bands before you guys. But for me, it really began with the MC5 and the Stooges in Detroit in 69. And so the first song that I played was Kick Out the Jams. However, I played the version with the motherfucker at the start of the track. So I'm on my friend's show. It's the first song of 10 that I'm supposed to be playing. I set it all up. I contextualize it. I give him the vinyl. He drops the needle. Kick Out the Jams. Motherfuckers. And then he starts panicking and he's like, we've got to take the record off. I was like, no, it's fine. I completely forgot about that. That is my bad. But that is the only swear word in the song. Don't worry. The damage had already been done, of course. Thankfully, he got to keep his show. He wasn't ejected from it. But that was my rather illustrious debut in the world of radio, and was dropping a motherfucker within minutes of being on the air.
I'm so proud.
So I guess the story of the MC5 really begins in Detroit. I wonder if you could share with me some of your memories of growing up there, and, you know, that place obviously was for a period in time the epicenter, wasn't it, of industry and culture in America. And you had obviously all the car factories, and you had Motown, you had this influx of multiculturalism and masses of people flocking there in search of, you know, employment, and you obviously had the strong labor unions and everything there. What's your earliest memories of growing up in Detroit, and how did you see that city change over time?
My earliest memories were of schoolmates of color, you know, that I had black neighbors and Mexican neighbors, and to me, it was perfectly normal. I didn't really become aware of the fact that America was a segregated nation until I started to go on tour in the MC5 as a young man to see that, you know, all the white people lived over here and all the people of color lived over there, because it wasn't like that growing up in Detroit for me. And, you know, my mother was a beautician, and she opened the first interracial beauty salon in Detroit. where white women and black women could both get their hair done in the same business. So, you know, those things were normal to me. It was very exciting to grow up in the 50s and early 60s in Detroit, because it was a boom town and all things were possible. Whatever you wanted to get into, you could find other people that were into it. And for me, you know, dreaming of one day being a professional musician, there was abundant employment. The clubs all over the city had live entertainment, and the factory workers worked three shifts. And these were a lot of young people, young men with good money in their pockets, and they wanted to go out and go to a club and meet a girl and have a drink. And so, you know, everything was possible. Wasn't till I became a teenager that I started to realize that people of color were not sharing in the prosperity of the boom town, that people of color were not part of the political establishment. They weren't part of the social establishment, the economic benefits that were as a result of the success of the auto industry. And they were, people of color were on the receiving end of thuggery by the Detroit Police Department. And, you know, as I became a young man and was part of a generation that saw the nation as hypocritical and disconnected from the reality of people's lives, it forced me into a militant stance. I was frustrated with the slow pace of change, and I felt like maybe with my band and my friends in our community, we founded the White Panther Party to endorse the Black Panther Party and to do parallel but separate work in our own community.
How have you found this year in the events of the, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement? And have you seen any parallels between what was going on, you know, when you were growing up and now? Is it different? Is it similar? You must have noticed certain patterns that remind you of then, but I was interested to know whether you thought about the ways in which things are different now as well.
Well, the main difference is, of course, social media.
Yeah.
But the actual organizational dynamic of, you know, people taking to the street, you know, a lot of that's the same, but a lot of it's different because I'm not sure that street protests will get us anywhere. Rage is not a strategy. Rage isn't a plan. You know, people go on the street because they're angry, but things don't change because you're angry. You can get a start there. That can be the instigation of change. But change comes very slowly and with a lot of hard work, work that isn't sexy, you know, work that isn't glamorous. You know, it's not exciting. It's just work, organizing communities, organizing pressure on politicians. I mean, I was reading an interview yesterday with Angela Davis, one of my intellectual and political heroes. And she said it's the activist's job to prepare the next generation to push the leadership to more progressive policies, because on their own, they won't change. They only change when pressure is brought to bear.
Do you feel, because I feel like back in the 60s, you know, from somebody who didn't live through those times but has studied them at great length, it seemed like then music did have the power to affect positive change. It could change the world. I feel like music had that vital potency back then. I don't feel like that's the case anymore. I'd love to get your thoughts on whether you think that, you know, music and art has that same potency and power to change the world, or is it a bit too diluted and there's just too much quote unquote content now that the impact and the immediacy of it has been watered down? What's your thoughts, Wayne?
I agree with you. In the 60s, our music, the music of the younger generation was like our town hall meeting. That's where we all met. You know, if you loved a Rolling Stones song and I loved that song, then we were both Rolling Stone fans and we met in the song. And some of the songs carried a powerful message. Bob Dylan's songs, Blowing in the Wind, the Masters of War. These were powerful expressions of the frustration that we all felt. Today, music is one of 100 distractions, really. You know, it's my belief that art, and in our case, music, is its purpose is to make you think, to make you feel, to make you question. And what we have today is art and music that's designed to distract you,
yeah,
to keep you amused for a while. And then they shut it off at 11 p.m. So you go to bed and get up in the morning and serve your corporate master again tomorrow.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because back when you were coming up, like, there was plenty to write about and rally against. I don't think there's any less things to be inspired by and angry about now. It's just that people aren't doing it for whatever reason.
Well, it doesn't affect most people. I mean, in this country, you know, it's a very, very small percentage of the population that fights the wars. In the 60s, you know, all young men were subject to conscription. And so everyone, the war was brought home, it was brought home to your own dinner table. Today, you know, that's something that exists off in the distance somewhere. Just like, the people that support Donald Trump, they're angry and they don't understand how the world has changed. They want the world to stay like they think it was in the 50s, where this was a white nation and everybody went along with the program. Well, the fact is, this is not a white nation. This is a diverse nation of all kinds of cultures, gay people there's a part of the population, mostly non-college educated white men, who they just don't understand it. They don't get it, and what they don't understand, they fear, and so they support authoritarian like Trump to express their anger.
You mentioned the White Panther Party a moment ago. I'd love to talk to you about John Sinclair and his role in the early years of MC5 and his, I don't know, his character. Like, what was he like as a guy, first of all? He seems like a unique individual.
He was a just bigger than life, charismatic, hilarious, wicked smart fellow. He was a few years older than me, and he became my mentor, and he taught me a great deal about how the world works and how we got where we are today. And he exposed me to the free jazz movement, for which I will be eternally grateful, because, I was a young man I was 19, I think, when I met him, or maybe 18. And, I had this rock band, the MC5, and, we were doing some interesting things. You know, I was inspired by some of the British artists like Pete Townsend and Jeff Beck. And I was trying to figure out where to go with the guitar, the electric guitar, and with my band. And when I discovered the free jazz movement, the path became clear that the future was in going beyond the beat and beyond the key to a more pure sonic dimension.
And that obviously complemented the incendiary politics in the lyrics and the songs as well, right? The two were a package that served each other, that had a powerful impact. And obviously the first record famously was recorded live. Was the goal for you guys to just be like the most ferocious live band on the planet when you were starting out? Was that the intent of the MC5? Was let's get out there, let's play everywhere, let's hone this live show and let's fucking attack them with our sounds, with our ideas, with everything?
I couldn't have put it better myself. Yeah, we didn't want to entertain people. We wanted to destroy them. We wanted our performances to be a life-changing experience that you will have never seen or heard anything like what we're about to do to you. And for the most part, that was true. There were no bands with the intent that the MC5 had, because we addressed our audience's concerns directly, head on. When I stood on stage and raised my fist in the Power to the People salute, and the kids in the audience raised it back, we made a powerful connection that said we understood each other, that we shared the same fears and the same hopes and the same anxiety and the same dreams. Where a lot of the bands, you know, I've studied Elmore James. I'm a blues man.
Yeah.
Well, okay, great. But, you know, I think there's something more important going on than that.
I was reading that, you know, early on you would open up for a couple of bands of note, like Big Brother and the Holding Company and Cream, and you would blow them off the stage. Is that right? Like, did you kind of get to, you know, open up for acts that were more well-known at that stage than you guys, and did you give them a serious run for their money with your live show?
Every time. Yeah. And it was something we actually planned and carried through on. You know, we wanted to hurt their feelings.
Incredible. And you obviously didn't just play music venues either. It sounds like you guys played everywhere and anywhere that they'd have you. And even some cases when they didn't want you, you'd still set up and play anyway. Are there any famous ones that spring to mind? I know the one you talk about and get asked about, I'm sure, the most is the Democrat convention. But were there a lot of incidences and events and occasions like that where, you know, it was just chaos?
Yeah. Yeah. In those days, there were a lot of these small regional festivals, you know, the Saugatuck Pop Festival, which, you know, might have drawn 2,000 people. But they were great events for us. And sometimes, you know, the police would go on a rampage. Sometimes it was, you know, a group of bikers. We played a lot of riots.
Have you seen them? Have you seen the new movie on Netflix yet, Wayne, the Chicago 7 film?
I have not seen it, but I've read a great deal about it, and we've been talking about it a lot. And apparently, Zemeckis rewrote history. You know, he had the transcripts from the trial, which could not be more dramatic. And then he has a band playing in the park that's like a folk band.
Yep.
You know, the MC5 was the only band to play And, you know, we hardly played folk music. I mean, it was folk music in a larger sense, but it wasn't folk music like Peter, Paul, and Mary folk music.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed in hearing about it. I've yet to see the film, but so far it doesn't sound good. It happens all the time in the movie business. You know, they rewrite history, but it was unnecessary in this case. History would have been fine.
And you obviously lived it. And I mean, the level of brutality and violence on display that day, was it like, was it savage?
Oh, absolutely. And we all knew it was coming. You know, the Chicago Police Department was infamous. Everyone knew across the country that there was going to be a police riot. And, you know, they were the biggest gang in town.
It's lucky you got out then, isn't it?
Yeah, well, we had played enough riots where we knew that once the band stops playing and the crowd doesn't have anything to focus on, the riot will start. So we knew that's what was going to happen. And the minute we finished our set, we threw our gear in the van and got the hell out of there.
Smart move. How well did you know people like Fred Hampton and Huey Newton? Did you know those guys on a personal level?
I didn't know Fred or Huey, but I knew David. I still know David Hilliard and Sam Napier from the Oakland Black Panther Party. And we had Black Panthers in Detroit and Ann Arbor that we were friends with and are still friends with.
There's so many interesting figures from that time I'd love to just pick your brain about quickly. Allen Ginsberg, did you ever have any interactions or experiences with him?
We played a show early in the band. Once in the beginning, when Sinclair decided to manage the band, there was an event at Wayne State University in Detroit. And it was like a literary, poetic rock concert, and Allen Ginsberg came and he did some poetry and engaged the audience, and then the MC5 played, and afterwards I went to him and said, Allen, what did you think of our band, you know? And he said, sounded like the cosmos smashing into each other, that planets were exploding and bursting in space. Which I thought, wow, great review.
That's the best description you could hope for, isn't it?
Well,
how about Danny Fields, Wayne? He was a key figure early on as well, right? In getting you guys signed and kicking off the whole campaign.
Yeah, Danny was the talent scout for Elektra Records. In those days, they called him the house freak. And his job was to go out and find exciting new acts. And he came out to Detroit and saw 3,000 kids going crazy for a band that never made an album, that, you know, were virtually unknown outside of Detroit. And he went back and told his bosses that, you know, there's a band up there that's fantastic. He asked me at one point, are there any other bands around like the MC5? And I said, no, there are no other bands like the MC5. But you will need to see our brother band, the Psychedelic Stooges. And of course, he loved the Stooges and signed both bands on the same night.
Incredible. And they're the two bands for me that really got it all started and inspired everything that followed. And obviously, as you say, very different bands. Iggy back then, was he like that star in the making even early on? Could you see that there's, you know, this great force on stage and this fucking powerful front man was inside him and was getting ready to unleash on the world?
It was undeniable. He brought so much to the table that just over, you know, it overwhelmed audiences, and a lot of them were hostile to the Stooges. And, you know, we had them play with us dozens and dozens and dozens of times all over the Midwest. And sometimes it got rough, you know, those those factory rats and greasers, they didn't know what to make of this guy out there dancing like a, you know, like a demon, you know, who shaved his eyebrows off and was wearing white mime face. And the band, the music was so primal and simple and dense that they didn't know what to make of it sometimes. It was great. I loved every night with them. And they were my personal friends. And Iggy and I are still great friends to this day.
Why do you think it was that what you guys were doing sounded so different and was so different by its very nature and content to what was going on the West Coast of America at that time with the hippie psychedelic scene and flower power? Like, it's night and day, isn't it, between what was going on over there and what was happening in Detroit? Was it the geography and the vibe in the air of the two cities, obviously LA and Detroit being so different? Was that really what made it what it was, or was there other elements at play?
I think there were other elements applied. I think this may sound like a stretch, but I think that organized labor movement that originated in Detroit with United Auto Workers generated, and Detroit being a industrial city, manufacturing city, that there was the sense of honor in hard work, that hard labor was an honorable thing, a noble thing to undertake. You know, working in the factory was hard, but it paid well, and a guy could raise his family on that money. Detroit has a long, long tradition going back to the turn of the century of great musicianship. You know, when the touring big bands needed like a new tenor player or a new trombone player, they went to Detroit because at Northwestern High School and at Cass Tech, the music programs were the best in the country, and Detroit produced the best musicians. So the bar was much higher for us in Detroit. You know, we knew what mastering your instrument meant. We knew how to play in time. We knew how to construct songs. And I don't think that the bar was that high on the West Coast. I mean, these guys, they were all folk musicians who, you know, got electric guitars, but never really understood how to use them. And the rhythm sections on the West Coast, I thought, were always subpar. I mean, in Detroit, we all wanted to sound like that Motown recording band,
yeah,
who are the best band in the world.
Yeah, so tight. And as you say, just perfectly crafted songs. Like when you think about that assembly line, which is kind of what it was, wasn't it? In the same way the factories were, you know, it was an assembly line of hits, and they just churned them out. Do you think when Motown left Detroit, that had a negative effect on the city? When do you feel like the city began to fall on hard times?
Well, I think the inflection point was the rebellion of 1967. There had already been a white flight in place. You know, white people were leaving the city and moving out to the suburbs. And after the rebellion, everyone armed themselves. I mean, Detroit used to be an average city like any other city, but after the rebellion and people, guns flooded the city, you know, everything started to become dangerous. You know, heroin invaded the city at the same time. And so you had kind of a perfect storm. The auto industry started collapsing. So you've got, you know, tens of thousands of workers with no work, no money, and, you know, desperate situations develop, and desperate situations often instigate desperate acts. And many people turn to antisocial behavior. And, you know, the city became the murder capital of America. One year we had over 800 murders in Detroit. I mean, it got very scary.
What elements do you think were at play and conspiring against your band as well? Because when you look back at those first three albums, and I know you've spoken in the past about how you've kind of got certain issues with the sound quality of them for different reasons, perhaps. I think they're flawless and amazing. I particularly love Back in the USA. I think that's such a great rock and roll record. High Time obviously was kind of an indication of where the band might have taken things even further. But they were great albums. You were out there, you were doing it. What do you think it was that slowed the band down, that got in your way, that ultimately tore you all apart?
Well, I only know this in retrospect, you know, but as I look back on it, I think one of the key factors was John Sinclair going to prison for 9.5 to 10 years for possession of two joints. He was our interlocutor to the world of the music business.
Right.
You know, when he went to prison, we did not have a representative. That I think that was the difference. You know, we didn't have a Bill Graham in Detroit, you know, someone that understood business, someone that advocated for the artist. And I was basically left on my own to try to figure out what to do with how to manage the band. And, you know, the dynamic of the industry is such that it's virtually impossible to represent yourself. What was exciting and thrilling in 1968 by 1971 was getting very complicated. And when Kick Out the Jams was banned, that was another straw to add to the camel's back, and we never really recovered from that censorship, you know, that suppression. The MC5, you know, we wanted to change the world. We weren't just concerned with being a hit band. We had a bigger agenda in our back pocket. And after a while, the music industry said, you know, these guys are just too much trouble. And we were too much trouble. We were crazy. And they had new bands that, you know, just wanted to boogie or just wanted to be stars. And, I wanted to be a star too, but I wanted, you know, an end to the war. I wanted civil rights for all Americans. I wanted justice. I wanted peace. I wanted a beautiful, creative existence. And what I got was Richard Nixon and FBI suppression. And in the end, my own frailty turned to substance abuse, and that never helps the situation.
Of course.
So, yeah, there were a lot of things stacked up against the idea of these five guys from Detroit who had this revolutionary sound and a militant political stance. There was a lot working against us. And most of it, or at least a great deal of it, came from inside the band itself.
Yeah, yeah. And when the band does end, do you fall on real hard personal times then? Does that affect you in a very deep, negative way, the end of your dreams, as it were?
Destroyed me. I didn't even realize the loss that I suffered, you know. It was not only a rock band, but this was my community. These were my best friends. This was my place amongst my peers. My status, my identity was all wrapped up in being Wayne Kramer from the MC5. And when that went away, I was not prepared to cope with it successfully. And I turned to anesthetizing myself with vodka and heroin.
And then you get arrested, right? And you do, is it 3 years you spent in jail? 2 years? How long were you inside?
Just about 3 years. The judge gave me 4, but I was a model prisoner, so they let me out a little bit early. Yeah, I had just lost my connection to everything that was important to me and fell in with a very rough group of fellows. And, you know, the truth is, I'm not a gangster. I'm not a killer. I'm not a gunslinger. And I had no business doing the things I was doing. And clearly I wasn't very good at it because I got busted right away a few times.
So, yeah, you were running with some serious criminals, were you? It wasn't just like a John Sinclair thing where you just got a bit of personal on you and it's possession. Were you rolling with some dark dudes?
They were heavyweights. And it was very dangerous. I very narrowly avoided being murdered myself.
How was jail? Awful.
Yeah, of course. You know, the main reason is you can't go home.
Yeah, you are home, you know, and home sucks.
If they don't want you to eat, you're not going to eat. And they don't want you to sleep, you're not going to sleep. And if you want to play it tough, they can play it tougher. So I learned pretty quickly how to do my own time, and I discovered that if I just used the skills I had as a musician, I could establish myself as a member of the prison community and be of service to it by putting on regular concerts for my fellows, which everyone appreciated.
Yeah, you're obviously an example of, you know, rehabilitation working. Do you feel like the correctional system in America has changed since you were inside? Do you feel like that possibility of rehabilitation and redemption is still available to people who are getting convicted? What's your thoughts on the correctional system then and now?
Well, I went to prison at the end of the era of rehabilitation in American corrections. I saw it coming, and they told us that, you know, all the rehabilitation programs are going to end, and now it's going to just be human warehousing. We're going to warehouse people. And I watched for 30 years after I was released, as more and more people just like me went to prison for longer sentences under worse conditions, and found it infuriating. And finally, I got so angry that I knew if I didn't take action that this could eat me up. And I know that today the only way I can militantly oppose meaninglessness. Excuse me just a minute.
No worries.
Can you hold the line just a second, please?
Of course.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than 1 billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
My son is across the hall with his remote school, and he lost the connection.
Parenting in 2020, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Doing the teacher's jobs for them.
Yeah.
So sorry, Wayne, you were saying about how you caught the tail end of the rehabilitation years.
Yeah. So in the ensuing 3 decades, you know, get tough on crime policies, politicians started to realize that there were votes in being perceived as, quote, tough on crime. So they passed some very bad laws and started locking people up on a massed scale. And today in America, we have hyper-incarceration, which was slowly turning back towards rehabilitation, because what would happen is that they would lock a person up for 10 or 20 years in a environment that inculcates them in violence, racism, bitterness, defeat, resentment, and then put them back on the street with no programs, no help, no therapy, no education, and expect them to rejoin civic life. And it doesn't work that way. So what we ended up with is, as a result of mass incarceration, we were not safer, we were less safe. So the country has started to realize that, and we've started to see a shift. Certainly since the coming of the pandemic, more people are being released because they can't afford to care for the, you know, the 2.3 million Americans in prison. You know, when I served my sentence in the 1970s, there were 350,000 people in prison in the whole nation. Today it's 2.3 million.
There's a really good affecting documentary again on Netflix called The 13th. I don't know if you've seen that, but you're probably completely up, sure, completely up to speed with everything they cover in that anyway. But that was an incredibly eye-opening watch for me as somebody, yeah, who lives, you know, in the UK, and you realize the extent of, you know, the money that's involved in the prison system, yep, and how it's all really driven by that, and the kind of, you know, updating and subtle legalizing again of basically slavery, isn't it? Is sort of what's explored in that film, is like, you know, if we can't legally have slavery, let's incarcerate these people and enslave them that way. It's so fucked up.
The economics is the most formidable aspect of the challenge in justice reform. You know, this is a $90 billion a year industry. You know, they, you know, guard salaries, guard uniforms, the food that prisoners eat, the clothes they wear, the prisons themselves, all these things are bought and paid for by taxpayer money. And they've reached a point of diminishing returns. They cannot build any more prisons and lock up more people. The state governments just can't, their economies cannot handle it. The federal government is handling it better because they don't have a money problem. But still, the effects on the society, the damage being done is incalculable. Entire communities have been decimated. Families, millions of families have been destroyed as a result of these get tough on crime policies. It's really been, the, you know, along with the war on drugs, the greatest failure of social policy in American history.
Did you get clean when you were in jail, and did you stay clean once you got out? Was that you then home free in that sense, or did you still struggle with addiction issues when you were released?
No, I didn't get clean in prison. Prison, drugs are as easily available in prison as they are on the street. And I came out with nothing but willpower, and that's not enough. And I continued to be an active alcoholic and drug addict for years. I didn't get sober until I was 50 years old. I'm 72 now.
So did you spend the latter half of the 70s and most of the 80s kind of off grid in a creative sense, and kind of, yeah, just wrecking it?
That's a good way to put it. I was off the grid.
Because I'm looking at the history of, you know, your life and your work, and you have this incredible run of records in the 90s with Epitaph, and that must have been such an exciting time for you because that label at that time was booming. Punk rock and guitar music at that time was booming, especially the first record you come out with, The Hard Stuff, is so great, and for me ranks, you know, amongst the best stuff you've done. But I was like, what about this big period before that? So that was really just still struggling and fighting with booze and drugs, was it? And just kind of working to live.
I was drunk. And I was stoned. And, you know, the only thing being drunk and stoned is good for is being drunk and stoned.
Yep.
You know, it's almost, certainly for me, it's impossible to be creative if I'm abusing opiates or I'm drinking. You know, to be creative, you need to have that inner fire, that desire to create something, that need to do this. You know, you have to, you can't not do it. And if I'm stoned, I don't need to do that because all my needs are met. I'm stoned. Of course, that's unfortunately a great delusion. And it wasn't until I got sober again that I, you know, discovered that I can look inward and find plenty in there to talk about, and plenty. I have no limit of the amount of music I can create. You know, today as a film and TV composer, if someone hires me to score a film for them, we're not waiting for Wayne to be inspired. You have to start writing music now, and you have to get it done on a deadline. You know, everything works on a schedule, and I can do it. I have no problem doing it these days. In fact, I love it. I enjoy the process.
What was your moment of clarity then? When and how did that present itself when you decided, okay, enough's enough, it's time to get myself sorted? Was there one event, or was it a slow, gradual realization that eventually just it couldn't go on and you had to change? What was it that kicked you into gear and got you, you know, driven and motivated to clean up?
Well, it was, you know, my awakening was of the educational variety. I had done a lot of research. You know, I'd been using and dependent on substances for a long time. And the only thing that ever really got through to me was pain. When it hurt so bad to continue that I thought it might be better, let me just try this being sober. Let's see how that works. And I found I had a much better outcome. I think the single inflection point was I was returning from a European tour and in my Epitaph days, and I was up in the air and I didn't have to go anywhere. I didn't have to see anybody. I didn't have to do anything. And I thought it'd be okay if I got hammered. And I woke up with a young female flight attendant telling me that she was going to have me arrested when we landed in the United States, that she had been warning me for a long time about the yelling and the cursing. And it was in that moment that I realized that I was, in fact, a drunken, stoned, rock and roll asshole, just the kind of guys that I loathe. You know, I'll cross the street to avoid talking to people sometimes just because, you know, they're too big of jerks. And that was me. That's who I am. And that's when I realized I was really ill. I was a sick man and I needed to get some help. And I got back to LA and I called a friend of mine and asked him if he could help me. And he said, yeah, Wayne, we don't shoot the wounded. Which was a just beautifully compassionate thing to say. And that was the, you know, beginning of my sober life and the good life, the abundant life that I get to experience today. You know, I have a beautiful wife and a beautiful son, and I enjoy the respect of my peers, and I have good friendships that I can enjoy, and I can be a friend to my friends, and I can be a husband to my wife, and I can be a boss to my employees, and I can be a student to my teachers.
And you're at peace with your past now?
Yeah, for the most part, sure. I mean, you know, these things, they're always there, and, you know, I'm an imperfect man. I don't do any of this stuff perfectly, but I put in 100%. I'm in it full measures.
When you begin to, you know, lose your friends and contemporaries, and that element of life starts to become more omnipresent everywhere, mortality, do you find yourself thinking a lot more about life and death as that's happening around you, or do you try and stay present in the moment and just enjoy life? But obviously it must be there to some extent on your mind. Like, are you a spiritual person? What do you think happens when we leave this mortal coil?
I'm not a spiritual person. I have absolutely no regard for anything supernatural. I believe in the natural world. You know, when you're dead, you're dead. You're not thinking thoughts anymore. You're not feeling feelings. You don't exist anymore. You were here for a second, and then you're gone. That's just the way it goes. Yes, I think about death often. You know, this is one of the great questions of life on Earth. You know, how does that work? You know, we're born to die, and there's a larger natural cycle that takes place. So yeah, but what I've found is it works for me is if I start thinking about you know, not being here anymore, that to use that as inspiration to enjoy the experience of this moment. You know, I'm not so much interested in the meaning of life as I am in the experience of life.
I like that. And legacy, Wayne, is that important to you? Do you give that much consideration? And if so, how would you like to be remembered?
I don't, because my interests are focused on doing the best I can in the day I'm in. You know, we're all leaving.
That's the only certainty, right?
Yes, we're all going to fade into the nothingness of history. Very few people are remembered over, you know, long millennia. And I don't expect to be one of them. I just know that what I can make happen right here, right now, is the best I can do, and I try to do that. And I'm not too concerned. I mean, certainly I've made arrangements to care for my son, and I have a advance directive, and I have a will, and I have a trust, and everything. Take care of my wife and my son, and I'll be gone then.
So it doesn't directly affect you.
I won't be thinking thoughts.
Just before I let you go, and I want to say a big thank you for giving up your time and talking to me today. I knew it was going to be great, and it absolutely was. And thank you for the music and so many amazing things that we haven't had time to talk about. I'd like to talk very quickly, if it's okay. You mentioned film scoring, and a lot of people might not know this about you, but you've obviously done a lot of work with Adam McKay. And that for me, that for me is such a bizarre and brilliant pairing, because, you know, I wouldn't necessarily have put the kind of broad strokes of Will Ferrell comedy and kind of incendiary, hard-hitting guitar music together, but you did score Talladega Nights and Step Brothers. Where does that relationship with Adam begin, and what is the nature of that creative partnership that you guys share?
The brilliant producer, Hal Wilner, was the music supervisor on Talladega Nights. And they had a composer on the film, and he was good with the orchestra, but he could not rock. His rock music sounded like bad movie rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hal knew it, and Adam knew it. Adam's a huge music fan. And so Hal suggested they call Wayne Kramer, and I went over and met with him and just made an immediate connection with Adam. Politically, we were both left of left, and just found that we saw the world the same way. And we started working together, and a lot of opportunities came my way through Adam scoring Eastbound and Down.
I love that show so much.
I did a couple others. I did a show that just ran for one season called Bad Judge,
yep,
which was very funny. But, you know, it just turns out that Adam and I are great friends. And, you know, my wife is best friends with his wife. And we, you know, we all see each other as often as we can. And, you know, he was one of the guys that encouraged me to be a father. He said, you know, Wayne, you will love it. You're perfect for it. You should, yes, absolutely go for it. And he's right. I do love it. And fatherhood is the coolest thing I ever did.
It's amazing as well. You became a dad at 65, and obviously all the hard living and the juvenile behavior is well out the system by then. And, you know, I think you are in a good position to be the best mentor and carer and father figure. And what a trip it must be to reach that age and then have your life change so much. Most people, when they hit 65, not many big life-changing moments are still coming their way at that stage, are they? But for you, it's like a whole new chapter, isn't it?
Yeah, I get to be the new guy again.
final thing is the return of the MC5. I got to see you guys, the MC50, incredible show at the Alice Cooper concert last year. Such a powerful lineup. Billy from Faith No More, who I just spoke to the other week for this show. Kim from Soundgarden, obviously Brandon from Fugazi. I can't remember the name of the amazing singer, but he was on fire and incredible. And the sound, the power, it was so amazing for me as a lifelong fan of those songs to hear them live. And I know it's something you've been doing for a while. And is that something you would like to continue doing once, you know, concerts and things are allowed once again? Would you like to carry on doing the MC5 stuff and keep that train rolling?
Of course. You know, you spend your youth learning how to do something, building your skills and your relationships. And then you reach middle age, and in my case, I'm closing in on the senior period. And music is something that's not actually tied to youth. You can continue to develop your ideas and your abilities to become even more vivid and more stretched out. And so I feel like I'm playing better than I've ever played. I understand how a band works better. I think I'm a good band leader. And I love playing music for people. I mean, I got into this in the first place because they clap.
It must be amazing to, you know, still be playing those songs as well and have them just so rapturously received as they were at that Alice Cooper concert, and I'm sure as they were at all the shows you've been doing. It's amazing. And you must see, like, you know, young fans still in front of you as well, which, you know, 50 or so years almost after starting the band to still be like playing to, you know, excited young rock fans. That's a beautiful thing. And not a lot of people get to enjoy that, do they?
No, and you know, it wasn't a certainty for me. When we started MC50, we went to Europe and played a few festivals. And the first one we played, I think it was somewhere in Sweden or Denmark. And there might have been 5,000 kids. You know, maybe half of them had ever heard of the MC5. The other half had no idea who we were. And I knew that, and I was really clocking it closely. And by the third song, we had won the audience over. They understood exactly who we were.
Hell yeah.
You know, this hard rock music, everybody gets it. Everyone understands it. And it didn't take long for them to warm up to the band. And then the crowd continued to build. By the time we finished the set, we had probably twice the audience. You know how it is at festivals. People walk around from one stage to the other. And we drew more and more people. So once I knew that the music still had a compelling force to it, I knew we'd be all right. And of course, now we've toured all over the world, and we have a ball every night. The band really plays well together, and we enjoy what we're doing, and that's contagious.
And, you know, there's so many bands that have been influenced by you that even if they don't know the name or the songs, these younger audience members, I think, as you say, as soon as you present what you do to them, they make that connection and go, oh, yeah, this is like Rage Against the Machine or At the Drive-In, or, you know, I know this sound. I know this aesthetic.
Right.
The tour that needs to happen next year or soon in the future is Rage Against the Machine MC50 opening. That's the one, right?
Just before the pandemic hit, I ran into Zach just when they had just agreed to do it. And he said, man, whatever you want, Wayne. So I don't know. I might revisit that.
Hell yeah. Needs to happen. Wayne, thank you so much, man. You're a legend. You're a gentleman. I really, really enjoyed this, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed talking to you.
I hope to see you in person someday, man. I'll get down to a show and make myself known and say hello. But yeah. Thanks
make
again.
Make sure you come backstage so I can put a face to the voice.
I'll be sure to do that. Have a great day and good luck with the rest of homeschooling. keeping you on your toes with these Zoom classes. Thanks so much, Wayne. Please say thank you to your lovely wife as well for all her help in making this happen as well. She's been amazing.
Will do.
Thank you, mate. Till next time.
Bye-bye.
When it happened, something snapped inside, made me want to hide. All alone on my own. All alone on my own. I stood up on the stand with my eyes shut tight. Didn't want to see anybody. Feeling happy, having a good time now.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.